everyone, and welcome to Upzoned, where every week we take just one big story from the news or from the Strongtown's extended universe, and we upzone it. Usually we don't have a small dog crying in the background. You might hear that a little bit on my end. I did get a puppy, and he's really cute, but he's a little anxious about being in the crate right now because I just got him in. I'm sorry, but that's what the magic of editing is for. Hopefully we'll be able to minimize that noise
for
you.
Oh, come on now. Everybody wants to hear him a little bit.
I know. He is a really good boy. His name is Zozo, and he just had a very nice lunch. So this is Kia, by the way, and I'm here with Chuck. How are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing great. And my he's probably about 15 months now, we think. We got him from the rescue place, so we don't know exactly, but he's just chilling out, just laying here. So it gets easier.
I know. Gryffindor's like over a year. Zozo is a grand total of 16 weeks. He's brand new, so he's just got time to learn. But now that I've moved my table a little closer, he seems to be good. Here's an awkward segue into our topic. Today I wanted to talk about small enclosures that contain people and things.
Wow.
We're going to talk about garages. There's a really shockingly interesting, I know everyone's like, oh, garages, article about the evolution of the private home garage in America out of the New Yorker. As always, we will leave that link in the article description or the podcast description, excuse me, for you so you can read it yourself. But I brought this to your attention, Chuck, because I am always interested in not counterpoints, but complements to the conversation we have at Strongtowns about how autocentricity came to dominate our places, right? Like, right. We talk at Strongtowns all the time about how there are real serious bad economic incentives out there to build your world around cars. You know, like, we call that growth. We get politicians elected on their ability to build infrastructure. We, you know, there's every reason in the world for that to happen. But then there's also this other kind of other aspect of it, which is marketing. We've made cars really sexy to a certain segment of the population. We have made a suburban home with a detached garage part of the mystique of the American dream. I'm wondering if you found that line of reasoning persuasive in the article and what you thought of the piece. I just thought it was an interesting one.
Everything in the New Yorker is really well written, so it's pretty hard not to enjoy reading something in the New Yorker. I kind of stopped on the second paragraph. I'm going to read the first sentence here. No one truly needs a domestic garage to park a car. Space is available, if not readily, on city streets. The reason I stopped on that sentence, I literally tonight have a planning commission meeting in my town where I sit on the planning commission, and someone's coming in and asking for a variance to build a garage. And one of the arguments, and it's a very frequent argument, is tonight it's going to be 7 below. If you live in Minnesota, you must have a garage. It's fascinating because everywhere I've lived from where I grew up to now has had a garage. The house we're in now is in the middle of town. It's in an urban neighborhood. I don't park in the garage. It's the first time in my life. I mean, my parents have garage. I had a garage at my last house. We have a small little, I suppose we could fit one car in there if we wanted to, but we never use it that way. We park our bikes in there and stuff, but it's never for cars. Cars park out on the street. It's fascinating because, you know, we have evolved this kind of sense of needing garage space. And I think the article takes it in a bunch of different directions. But if you want to focus on just that part of how that evolved, I think the New Yorker kind of missed something.
That's a good point. And I did think about that. I feel like I know some neighborhoods where it's illegal to park on the street, where it's like all but required that you have a private garage because you're living way out in the sticks. And unless you're a temporary guest, they don't want cars muddying up their pretty cul-de-sacs, right? Like, that's not completely uncommon. This article is written by an author from Philadelphia. It's got a very specific perspective, but I think it does raise an interesting point about street life that I think is very fascinating. The idea that maybe if we relied more on like paid on-street parking and devoted more of our private living spaces to living rather than these like closed off activities that happen in garages. And we'll get into some of those besides just parking a car soon, that our cities would be better off. I thought that was a very weird turn, because we often talk about parking at strong towns in terms of there is no such thing as free parking. And we expect street parking to be free when actually it is being heavily subsidized by all other modes of transportation and by debt, frankly. But what do you think of the argument that the private garage could just go away if we reckoned with the real cost of public on-street parking?
There's a couple responses to that. The first one, it's very clear reading this article that this is someone who lives in an urban area, not in a suburb or a small town, where this conversation is very different. And I think the economics are also very different. So, you know, you're getting a one data point perspective. If we look at that data point, what I find really interesting is the notion that this is a good use of urban space, you know, garages. I think a lot of what has happened, and I think this is kind of the key insight that maybe is missing here, is that when you lock places in, when you essentially don't allow them to incrementally grow and expand, to change and evolve, but you say, you know, here's what this neighborhood is going to be through zoning, and it's never going to change. You almost, by limiting the number of things you can do, make this low value use of a garage something that's kind of logical. I mean, what else are you going to do with that space? I might as well park my car there. You know, I've got a car. I want to use it, you know, have it stored inside. There's nothing else I can do. I mean, I can't rent out that space. I can't create an accessory apartment. I can't, you know, go through the long list of things, make a whole nother unit. You know, there's all these things I can't do. So in a sense, parking becomes the highest and best use because it's the only use. I think the interesting thing is how we quickly find other things to do with this space, because parking a car inside, even here in Minnesota, where it is, you know, brutally cold at times, and there are nights where your car won't start the next day, if it's a certain age of car and if it gets down to a certain temperature, even then, boy, to use that space, to dedicate that much, you know, land and space and capital to just keeping your car inside, it is kind of ridiculous.
It's true. But then this article kind of makes the point that sometimes we do lots of other things in a garage. We can't live in it, but we start companies out of it. You know, like Apple started in a garage. We have our like garage band practices. I'm guessing you did a fair bit of that in your youth, Chuck.
Did that? Yep.
Yeah, I can just picture you wailing on a drum set like behind someone's Pontiac or next to their golf clubs. It's very easy to imagine. And that there's this idea that these like street-facing private spaces like have a sort of mystique all their own, I found very intriguing, even though I like from an economics perspective, I'm like, build a co-working space. Like, what are we doing? like go into your living room and play the drums. It's okay. Like there are other ways to do this. What did you think of the arguments in the article about like, here's all the other things that garages have come to represent in the American psyche? I know it's a little off the strong towns topic, but I found it interesting.
I did too, although I think it's a little bit of, I was going to say chicken and egg argument, but it's really more, I think, reversing the cause and effect here, right? You know, we build these spaces to park vehicles. We find that parking vehicles is really a low value use of them. Ergo, we do other things with it. I think that's very true. I mean, I look at my garage today. I have a little tiny one car garage. I park my bikes in there, but we hang them from the side, so they don't take up a whole lot of space. I store our wood in there, you know, that we use in our fireplace. The dog has a doghouse in there that's heated. So he can go, you know, when we're gone, he hangs out there. You know, there's things like that in the garage, you know, garage bands. I've done that many, many times. At the end of the day, what of these things would not take place if I didn't have a garage? And the reality is none of them. You can look around the world and say, well, you know, are there bands in places that don't have garages? Yes. Do they play music? Yes. Do people invent things? Well, of course. Do you have bikes parked and wood stacked in places where there's not a garage? Of course you do. They're just done in different ways. Again, I kind of get back to the notion that we have been, I'm going to say forced, and I don't think that is the right word, but essentially, given not a lot of other options for how to make good use of property in urban areas. And so the garage has become like the logical outcome. And then I think you have this, how do we use this space that in real human terms is really valuable? I mean, it's right next to our house. We spent a lot of money on it. Seems kind of silly to just park your car in there and leave it. How do we make good use of this space? And that's what I think you see happening. I think the offshoot then is, okay, what if we didn't limit what you could do with this space? What if we actually freed it up? What would we see then? Yeah, you'd see garage bands and you would see people starting businesses and you would see all these other things that, you know, we kind of nostalgize today about the American garage. But I think you'd also see more people living in cities. I think you'd see people being able to have a second income and have a little bit of financial resiliency and stability if they could fix up and rent out their garage as a living unit. So I think those things are coming. I think they have to come. And I think that at the end of the day, I think the garage as an institution is going to be one of those 20th century things that, you know, 100 years from now, they're going to look back and go, what did they do? Why did they do that?
I really do think of garages as more subtractive than additive. You're talking about all these, like, you know, like, would people play music if the garage didn't exist? And it's like, duh, of course they will. But I also think, like, if I live on a block where almost no one has a garage except for my next door neighbor, and this is the neighbor who I never see ever because they go in and out through their rear garage. They never go out of their front door ever. We just had a huge blizzard here in St. Louis, like, and not to be too petty, but they have one of the nicer houses on the block. Theirs was the only house where the sidewalk wasn't cleared. Chris got out there and shoveled it for him. And we just had like a passive Midwestern moment. When you think about what could be added by perhaps that neighbor could walk their dog sometimes, that neighbor could go out and see, huh, the people in our neighborhood who get around in wheelchairs are having a really hard time getting around in front of our house. Maybe we should shovel it. That whole front of their house is invisible to them because the point of entry is in the rear. And that effect is something that, as a nosy neighbor, I fuss over a little bit. But on a systems level, I really wonder what the net effect of it is culture-wide.
Well, let me give you just some numbers too. And I'll use kind of rough numbers from where I'm at, understanding that it's radically different in other parts of the country. But you'll get the point. If we look at a house in my neighborhood as like $100 a square foot for finished space, and then you look at a garage as like $15 a square foot for built space, why do you want to populate your city with garages? When you have a city, and we like we do, where the value comes from the tax base, why do you want to insist or make it the only really, you know, viable option in your set of regulations that people build these low value, low returning kind of structures? Why wouldn't you want something that would be a higher value? If you can increase by 6 times, 7 times the amount of tax base just by having a different use of the property, why would you not do that? This is the kind of box we put ourselves in a sense. Here in Minnesota, everyone needs a garage. You know, culturally, you got to have one. And so if you don't have a garage, your property's not worth as much. And so, you know, go out and build this low value thing. And it's kind of crazy. You know, it's kind of crazy. We park on the street. It's just fine. It's not like I've got a junky car either. I mean, I got a nice car. I park on the street.
You just got a new car, right?
I actually last month bought a brand new car. Yep. I park it out on the street. And it just seems to me like, particularly in urban areas that are transitioning from places that have struggled to places where they're starting to see kind of renewed investment, why we would impose this suburban development ethic on it, you know, where you've got to have a garage and maybe even a two-stall garage, it just seems counterproductive in many, many, many ways. And this New Yorker article, as well written as it is, kind of nostalgizes some of them in a way that I think is more focusing on the effects than the cause.
To be fair, the article does say that like garages are monstrous, but it also is trying to investigate like why they came about. And I imagine the responses we're going to get to this podcast is, well, the reason we devote so much space to garages is because we devote all of our streets to cars. You need a car to get around and you want to secure your car, which is a huge chunk of most people's budget, you know, away from the elements. Your insurance rate goes go down if they have a garage. So the answer is transition is hard. But I think to turn it around and put more of a Strongtown slant on it, I would say if you devote less of your space to garages, then you can start devoting less of your money towards maintaining overbuilt roads. Then you shrink them and then you start building corner stores near your house where people can walk. And, you know, think of it in terms of what's positive rather than in terms of how tricky the transition will be, because this is how you build strong towns, not just how you say no to weakness. You know what I mean?
Amen. Our cities need to thicken up. And part of, I mean, I think the low-hanging fruit of thickening up a city is to convert garage space to something of a higher use. We talk a little bit about the city of Minneapolis and how they've changed their zoning code now to essentially outlaw or not restrict any neighborhood to just single-family homes, you know, allow more use. They've long had ADU requirements in a lot of their neighborhoods. So accessory dwelling units, the ability to take your garage and make it into an apartment. Those are simple, like first steps towards making better use of space. And, you know, if your city is not doing that, you need to have that conversation right now, because that should be legal everywhere.
Well, let's go to the down zone. I'm really curious to hear, since you are probably getting out a little bit more in that brand new car, listening to some audiobooks, Chuck. I know you're an audiobook fan like me. What media you've been enjoying this week? It doesn't have to be a book. It can be a movie or anything else that's been kind of on your hit list.
Do you know what I've recognized? And I think you've maybe picked up on this for me a little bit too. I'm working on this side project and that we'll talk about here in a few weeks, I think. I have been just reading a lot less, and a part of it is keeping my mind clear. That being said, the long-awaited, and if you're a Dan Carlin hardcore history fan, you know how agonizing it is to wait between episodes. I'm a fan. I'm also a contributor. I love his work. And this week, the latest hardcore history episode just came out. It's the second part of a series about basically the rise of Imperial Japan prior to World War II, and it ends with Pearl Harbor. And I'm assuming there'll be an episode 3 in this series, but having him tell stories is a wonderful way to spend time out walking with the dog, really.
Nice. Well, my dog walking, I'm in the club now, my dog walking listen has been Heartland by Sarah Smarsh. I don't know if you heard of that one. It got a lot of press as sort of like, he got nominated for the National Book Award, and it was advertised as like an alternative to J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. It's a memoir of growing up poor in the richest country in America. And it's from the perspective of a woman who's around my age, who basically her whole growing up had no idea that she was in poverty. And it was a really refreshingly honest, thoughtful, well-written take on how specifically this woman navigated the experience of being in Kansas, growing up in a family that lived in an over-mortgaged house that made it appear like they were not as destitute as frankly they were, and having to negotiate choices like where she went to college and like whether she would join the army in a way that not everyone in America had to negotiate. And I think it's really well done. I think if you haven't read Hillbilly Elegy at all, you know, White Trash, that sort of ilk of books that have been coming out, I think this would be a good one to start with. I wish this book had come out first, because it was my favorite of the marathon of these types of books I've read. So Heartland by Sarah Smarsh is my contribution to the down zone.
Can I tell you something?
Yeah.
So I do this monthly thing on KXE in northern Minnesota, local radio station. If anybody wants to listen to it, there's a podcast called Dig Deep that I'm on once a month. That is the compilation of our airtime. The woman who hosts that show, her name is Heidi Holton. She told me when she read my reading list from last year, she said, You gotta talk to Sarah Smarsh. You gotta do this. She did an interview with her, said it was the best book she read last year. Not only do I have it on my short list for reading, but we actually have a line on getting her on the podcast.
Oh, let's do it. So, yeah.
So that's going to happen here in the first half of 2019, no doubt.
So good. I think Strongtowns fans in particular will love this book, and they would love a conversation about this book, because she is such a fresh honest, personal take on this stuff that is nonetheless wise and like applicable to trends throughout our country. And I thought it was really uniquely smart as a memoir. I loved it.
Beautiful.
All right. Well, that is our show today. Thank you so much for listening to Upzoned. As always, you can leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. It always helps other people find the podcast. And if you want to help us keep making more of these, you can join the movement at strongtowns.org/membership. Any contribution of any amount goes a super long way. So thank you to everyone who has already joined up. I guess that's all we got. Take care of your dogs, and keep doing what you can to build a strong town.